Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. My name is Jeff Gibbs. I teach New Testament in the Exegetical Department, and this is the file or recording for the Epistle lesson. I believe it's Pentecost 11, or maybe 12. I always lose track, but it's the second reading appointed for Hebrews 11. It's actually quite a long reading. It starts at verse 17, and then in a sense, the narrow boundaries of the lesson go through verse 31, but then the parenthetical part finishes the chapter, and then it goes all the way on into chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. Now, what I thought I would do is to go very quickly through chapter 11, because it seems to me that it would be hard, you'd be hard-pressed to choose to preach on really any part other than the last three verses, that is the profound exhortation and Christology and soteriology, which is implicit in the chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. There's also some very interesting grammatical possibilities there. So again, obviously one could preach on the repeated piste examples, dative of means, by faith, Abraham and Moses and all the other Old Testament worthies, the martyri, the witnesses. But again, my recommendation would be that you focus on chapter 12, 1 to 3. But to get there, we will go very, very quickly through Hebrews 11, beginning at verse 17. So the writer begins as he continues the streak, as I indicated just a second ago, of datives of means, that is, piste. Verse, the feminine singular dative of pistis, by faith. And in verse 17, by faith, Abraham has offered Isaac because he was being tempted, perhaps a causal participle or maybe even temporal. And I just realized I said tempted, but tested. God was testing Abraham, not wanting him to do evil, but to see whether he would do good or evil. So by faith, Abraham has offered Isaac while he was being tested. And now we have after a perfect indicative, we have an imperfect indicative. And he did indeed offer the only begotten one, or the only son. This is a good example, by the way, of how monogenes does not necessarily mean only begotten, because of course Abraham had two sons whom he had begotten. But rather, monogenes means only and unique. And of course, in accordance with the promise of God, Isaac was in fact unique. Ishmael was not conceived according to the promise, but rather by a human plan. And of course, we all know how well those tend to turn out. So again, this imperfect indicative, you might give it an emphatic translation or something like that to bring out the verbal aspect of it. It's hard to do, of course, in English, hard to be precise. And so anyway, he did offer the only or unique one. And who is the he? The one who had received the promises, ha tas evangelias anadexamenas, to whom it was spoken that in Isaac, seed will be called to you. Quote from the Septuagint in a kind of a Hebraistic way of saying you will have seed, or your seed will be named. And the sentence goes on. We have some examples here of long sentences where you have one finite verb followed by a number of participles, sometimes present sim, sometimes aorist sim. Verse 19, because he reckoned that God was able to raise from the dead ones, often, therefore, he received him also in a parable. The way this is often translated is something like as an example or as a type. This is not a parable in the synoptic sense, but the writer to the Hebrews is keying in on the fact that Abraham actually believed that if Isaac had been slain, that God would raise him from the dead precisely because he was the child of promise. So, and Abraham was able to do this, of course, by faith. That is, he trusts in the promise. It would actually be easy, we've all felt this temptation hermeneutically, it would be easy to read chapter 11 and to magnify the men and women involved here. But of course, that's not the point. The point is the power of the promise when it is believed. And so it's of no little significance then that when the writer gets to his great big toi garun, therefore, with which he begins 12, verse 1, he doesn't exhort to faith so much as he proclaims Jesus as the source of faith. In that sense, in chapter 12 at the beginning there, the steadfastness will emerge, the faith will emerge when the hearers, both then and now, fix their eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. So it's a very important point. It's very basic, but it's also very important. So again, going just very quickly on in verse 20, for by faith Isaac blessed, also concerning the coming things, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau by faith. Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, and he worshipped upon the head of his staff. By faith Joseph, as he was dying, concerning the exodus of the sons of Israel. Now here we have Naaman, you know, made mention of. Normally this verb, or often this verb means remembered, but recalled, made mention of is the translation here. And concerning his bones, he gave commandment. I like this reference because it reminds us that the promises are not spiritual in the sense of otherworldly or non-corporeal, but from the very beginning, the promises of God are linked to the land, to human beings, to places and times. And of course, that means that the heavenly city, we heard about this in last week's reading from Hebrews 11, the heavenly city is not a city up there, but that it's a city that God will bring to pass down here, so that the promised land, as we learn from Romans 4 and other places, has become for God's believing people, the whole world. And of course, Jesus' beatitude, blessed are the lowly, for they will inherit the earth. Not just the land of Canaan, but the earth. Now the writer shifts to Moses, of course, verse 23. By faith, Moses, after he had been born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. They didn't fear the commandment of the king. By faith, Moses, when he had become great, denied to be called the son of the daughter of Pharaoh, choosing rather to suffer badly with God's people than to have the temporary reward, or I guess apalau zin means pleasure of sin, because he regarded as greater than the riches of Pharaoh, the treasures, riches that regarded. Put the pieces together, verse 26, a little bit better. Regarded a greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, the reproach of Christ. For he was looking ahead unto the reward. And again, the reward is eschatological. Moses will not have clearly and fully known this, of course, but for him, the first fulfillment of the promise was life in the promised land. Again, just going, skimming over the surface here, by faith, he left Egypt and so forth. Again, always by faith, verse 28, he offered the Passover, the shedding of blood, and so that the destroyer might not slay or touch their firstborn. By faith, he passed through the Red Sea and so forth. Verse 30, again, the refrain just continues. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did what she did. And then, of course, the writer to the Hebrews accelerates even faster than I'm accelerating right now. And what still shall I say, verse 32? For it fails me relating in order to the time fails me in order to relate concerning Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, both David and Samuel and the prophets. And of course, then there's this long litany, very rapid long litany of things that men and women of faith were able to do by faith. one really important point to make here is that by faith does not mean that life gets easier. By faith may very well mean that life remains difficult, but that one is able to persevere and able to endure. And perhaps the difficulty will never, ever go away. We have this kind of series of quote-unquote successful by faith encounters. They conquered kingdoms, verse 33, they worked righteousness, they received promises or attained to promises, verse 34, they quenched the power of fire. This all sounds very good, but then in verse 36, others beaten and whipped, right? And then verse 37, they were stoned, they died at the murder of a sword, they went around homeless, lacking, persecuted, badly treated. These were people, verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. So again, and in the context of Hebrews, the writer is offering these witnesses precisely because there is a difficult time of training and testing, as he'll call it in verse chapter 12. So again, it's very important not to give the impression that by faith means that that it comes out happy, as we normally define that adjective, happy. But rather, God's people are enabled to endure and to look forward to his promises' fulfillment by faith. When God calls us to do hard things and to endure difficult circumstances, we are able to do it by faith and only by faith. So again, it goes to go very fast, and one certainly could preach on the rest of chapter 11, but I thought we would fix our eyes, so to speak, a little bit more carefully on chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. So it begins with an unusual word that most of us have to look up. It's just simply a long inferential word, toigarun, therefore. Also, we, emphatic, subject, fronted. Right? The writer and his hearers, both ancient and modern, we. And now he goes to a participle construction, echantes, probably causal. Because we have so great, tas uton. And what do we have so great? So great a cloud, a nephos. This is a accusative singular neuter. It looks like a second declension noun, as if it would go nephos, nephu, but it's a third declension. So tas uton and perikemenon, the participle, are modifying nephos. What kind of a cloud? So great a cloud, so great a surrounding cloud. And the dative pronoun hemin goes with the participle, surrounding to us, or in English, just surrounding us, having been placed around us, cloud of martyron, witnesses. Now, this is a part of the picture, I think, that is theologically of some importance. The writer doesn't specify, but it seems to me there are two options. Either they are witnesses who are watching us, and that's what they're witnessing. And so sometimes you hear this articulated, especially because it's in the context of running a race. And so it's said that the Old Testament saints are watching us. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that idea. You could take it in some bad places. But I think rather, in view of the testimony that's just been given, what they're witnessing to is the faithfulness of God. Their testimony is about Christ and suffering the reproaches of Christ, as the writer said about Moses. So they're not witnesses because they're witnessing us, but for us, they're witnessing to the faithfulness of God. And we see their testimony about Christ, about God's promises. And so that's what encourages us. So again, the writer doesn't specify, but in light of the context, that latter meaning of witnesses seems to me to be much more likely, and of course it's theologically much more powerful. So therefore, since also we, because we have such a great surrounding to us cloud of witnesses, and now we have a participle from apotithemi. It's a middle participle. It means to put off. Let us put off every ankus, That is to say, every hindrance or every encumbrance, the New American Standard, I looked up, has, that's how they render it. Every encumbrance and every well-hinderable sin, sin which so easily trips us up, that wraps itself around our feet. So let us, the participle piggybacks onto the hortatory subjunctive trechamen, let us put off every encumbrance and the sin which quickly entangles us, and supply the and, through endurance, not a virtue that our society inculcates or values. We like instant results, or we move on to something else. Through endurance, trechamen, let us go on running the agona, the race, the contest. Now, which contest? The pra kemenon, the set in front of us, and the date of there going with the participle again. The contest which is set before us. And how shall we do this? From aphorao, to gaze at, verse 2, by, or while we gaze unto, the of faith beginner and completer, the archegon and the teleotain. So Jesus, who is then in apposition to the substantized noun, ton archegon kai teleotain, looking unto the beginner or author and the finisher or perfecter of faith, namely Jesus. Well, in a sense, that's all you need for a sermon, right? Eyes on the goal, and the goal is Jesus. Eyes on the one who begins faith and the one who brings us to its teleos, Jesus. That's when we get ourselves in trouble, is when we take our eyes off Jesus. And what shall we see when we look at Jesus, when we aphorao, set our gaze upon Jesus? The relative clause now explains who, us, and it's, of course, this is normally translated who, for, as if this were peri plus the genitive or hyper plus the genitive. But I've always found this interesting that it's anti plus the genitive. So there's one of two meanings. The standard one, of course, is who, for, the joy. Which joy? Once again, participle with followed by the dative, and it's pra kemi, which is repeated again as it was at the end of verse 1. Who for the being set before to him joy, hip emenen, aorist from hippomeno, endured the cross by, after he had despised shame. And then ta, which is postpositive, gets put in front of endexia, and then you fetch the verb from the end of the verse. He has sat, kekatheken, he has sat at the right hand of the throne of God. So if the prepositional phrase anti tes pra kemenes auto charas, if that means for, then Jesus is the one whom we see keeping the joy in mind. So because of the joy that would follow death and resurrection, follow the shame of the cross, Jesus is willing to endure the shame, despise the shame, and endure the cross. Now, that's the majority view, and probably the way it should be preached, but I just always feel the need to mention there's another view, and that is anti. It normally has this, plus the genitive, normally has a sense of replacement. Instead of, in place of. This is its normal theological meaning. And that, I think, could also make very fine sense here. Who, in place of the joy that was set before him. Now, what would that mean? Well, I suppose it could mean something like this. That is that, for instance, when he was tempted by Satan, said, worship me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world, or something like that. So you could say that Jesus was tempted to seize that joy, but in place of that, he despised the shame and has sat down at the right hand of God. Or you could probably do it more generally to say something like the theology of Philippians 2, that is, he did not regard equality with God something to be held onto or to be grasped illicitly. But you can see how that would actually change the meaning of the verse. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and I do think that the majority view is to take it in the kind of the normally translated sense of for, so that the joy is on the other side of the cross. But this other meaning has always struck me as interesting, and not least because it's by and away the normal meaning of ante plus the genitive. But it's Jesus that we're following. It's Jesus upon whom we are fixing our gaze, fixing our eyes. And so this is Jesus. That is, he knew that shame and suffering would come, and it was under the normal sense of, or the way it's normally taken, he knew the joy that was awaiting, and so he was willing to endure great difficulty. And so then are Christians. 4, verse 3, and then we'll finish off quickly. Analogizomai means to consider. For consider the having endured one, ton hippa memene kata, perfect participle active. And this is the word order is quite convoluted here to an English speaker. The adjective in between ton and the participle, toi autain, is a feminine singular accusative. So you have to find a feminine singular accusative noun, and it's actually at the end of the next line, antilogion, which means hostility or opposition. So you have to put those together. For consider the one who has endured such hostility, and then hippa plus the genitive, by sinners, ace auton unto himself, or ace plus the accusative can mean, and against, here it does mean against himself. And why should we consider this one? Purpose, in order that you may not, Comno means to grow weary. This is the aorist subjunctive. In order that you may not grow weary with respect to your lives, meno, which is ekleo means to give out or to lose heart in the middle, as you lose heart or something. 4, toi autais physiais, because of such sacrifices, God is eo aresteo. God is being pleased. God cares about us offering these sacrifices, not the old cultic sacrifices of the tabernacle or the temple. The sacrifice of praise. Thank offering of praise, we might say. And then verse 17, patho means to persuade or convince, and to be persuaded or be convinced here comes to mean obey. Obey the ruling ones, those who lead or rule you in the genitive. And epeketa is from epeko. It means to submit or be subject. And be subject. 4, emphatic, they themselves are agripneoing, are keeping watch on behalf of your lives, your not just your souls, of course, but your bodies as well, as with the understanding that, note we have host plus the participle again, with the conviction that they will give an account. You apodidomi alagon, that means to give an account. And notice that the participle here, this is quite rare, is a future participle. If you might conceivably remember the principal parts of didomi, it goes didomi dozo. And so dosantes, or in this case, apodosantes, would be future participle, active, masculine, plural, nominative. And it carries also the future sense as those who will give a lugon, an account. So, obey them. This is why God has put them over you. Again, pretty countercultural in democratic America. And why, to what purpose? In order that, with joy, they may do this, and not groaning. Stenazo means to groan. For this, that is, to not obey your leaders, this to you is alusiteles, harmful or unhelpful or unprofitable. So again, it's kind of life of the community stuff, and really, you know, you might begin with the very basic message, Jesus Christ, yesterday and today, the same and forever. But then, and this I think is a great challenge in the church today, then the assumption is that the listeners, the hearers, the members of the congregation actually see themselves as members of a community. And again, it's a great problem, easier and more easily taken care of when you're dealing with groups of 15 or 20 or 30, but the average congregation is much, much larger than that, not to say incredibly larger than that. So how is it that we can structure ourselves so as to have these communal exhortations actually make sense, and there'd be an opportunity to do that? So it's a lot in there. Again, whether a person chose the larger approach of the text or a smaller segment, either one could be profitable. And thank you very much.